You're listening to a DM podcast.
Just a quick warning, this podcast series contains discussions about crime, trauma, sexual abuse, drug use, and suicide. Listener discretion is advised.
I used to rob banks in the 80s and 90s and did 23 years in prison in three different states. It took 30 years to talk about the sexual abuse that happened to me and the spiral into crime, addiction, and depression that all occurred as a result. Now, having turned my life around, I talk openly to inspirational people about trauma, survival, transformation, and hope. I am Russell Mansell, and this is The Stick Up. Ian Roberts was a front row NRL footballer, known in the game for his toughness. In 1995, Ian Roberts came out in public and announced that he was gay. Ian Roberts now today is a gay icon that is changing the face of sport through conversations and education about equality. Ian Roberts, welcome to The Stick Up.
It's nice to be here, Russ. Thank you, mate. It's always good for me to get to be asked to do anything like this.
No, man. I remember reading, I was in prison and I read your book and I was just amazed.
Wow. Okay. That book came out, I think, in 96, 97.
Yeah, I read it in 97.
Wow. Okay. It's kind of weird because that book, everything in that book was real, like true, but it was a very pastel painted version of my life at that time. It was, you know, I was still coming to terms with coming out, basically, and walking around with a profile as a gay man. That was all a bit, and everyone knowing you're gay before anything else. That was potentially.
And you came out in 95, yeah.
94. I came out on the kangaroo tour. Like, the truth is, right, I was never really in. It was the worst kept secret in rugby league that I was gay, even when I was at South. I was clubbing. I was, like, living an out gay life. At South, it wasn't too bad. I wasn't ever made to feel uncomfortable. I mean, George Pickens, that is, had a conversation with me once, just saying that he was a bit concerned that people might be getting the wrong impression or whatever. But he was saying that out of, you know, general concern. And then when I went to Manly, my then partner Shane, we're still good friends now. I mean, Shane, everyone knew I was gay. I mean,
what year did you go to Manly?
1990. You know, remember the mascot, the seagull mascot, the guy who used to run around that big fluffy suit. Well, that was Shane, my partner. Okay. Everyone knew that. Everyone knew that. You know, it's like. And then it was almost, when I came out publicly, it was almost like a bit of allowing people to breathe out, just like, oh, you've finally done it, you know, and having spoken to reporters since then and asking them why they didn't ask me prior to me making that statement myself, like publicly, they were always said out of respect for you in your own time. So, I mean, that was done really it was kind of cool, like gracefully, like by the Australian media. I don't know if you remember Justin Fashanu in 1990, who was an English Premier League player, came out in 1990. He was the first man in a male contact team sport to come out. That's back in the time, mate, when there was no mobile phones and we used to have to sit and watch the TV, get your news or read a paper or in any local rags or the gay rags, whatever. But, you know, the British media were brutal to him. They just terrorised him. The English fans brutalised him too. He retired in 94 and he died of suicide in 98. I do remember in 1990 when I first went to Manly, I was going to come out publicly then. And having seen the way that the press and the supporters of the game over in England attacked him and
it's a form of terrorism.
It's exactly what it is, mate. But you're also looking at a very different time then too, mate. Mm. We now talk about the 90s, you know, like it was a very different environment. You know, like that's back in the time, you know, it sounds awful to say, that's back in the time when they were throwing gay men off cliffs around eastern suburbs, you know.
And touching on that, I was in jail with the guys that done that.
Yeah, I mean, we've come a long way, but we've still got a long way to go, mate. There's still an incredible amount of ignorance around all that. I mean, you know, and I'm talking about men's sport here. I think women's sport is all over this space, like, you know, the LGBTIQA plus space in and around sport. I think women's sport is, like, they kind of embrace diversity and inclusion, and it doesn't seem to be the issue. But I, particularly men's contact sports, I mean, we've just had Isaac Humphries, the basketball player, come out in the last couple of months. We had Josh Cavallero down in the A-League from Adelaide United, came out about 18 months ago. So there's been a bit of a trickle, but the truth is, mate, it's still there is still that I feel, particularly within, like I said, the sporting environment, that being gay is being a gay male in a contact sport is almost like it's seen as a weakness.
But you played at Souths. That South side, Bundy, Les Davidson, Mario Fennick, Craig Coleman.
Pretty scary
mate,
team.
That was the toughest. That was, and people talk about tough teams, and they talk about that being the toughest team ever.
Yeah, it was pretty scary. Like, and I, when I went to Souths, my first game was in 86, and the first game was in the Charity Shield against St George. And my growing up at that age, I was 20, my star players was Craig Young, and I was actually opposite Craig Young.
Craig Young at front row, arm hold up, squad copper.
Yeah. He was all head, and he was just like an oak tree, just all trunk. It was there was no limbs, it was just all trunk from the head down. Great player. But like you said, we had Bundy, like Dave Boyle, Hookie, Mario, Wayne Chisholm, Paulie Roberts was there as well. But we used to have this Craig Coleman tugger. We used to have this call Henry. I don't know if you know about this. Henry was, and I'm new to the team, right? I mean, these guys scared me. I was playing alongside of them.
I'll just explain what the call is.
It was called Henry. It's named after the famous Henry Morris from South Juniors, champion bloke. But it's Henry meant was an all-in. Like, we had to bung it on, you know? And I'll never forget it. There was a second, it was the second scrum of the game, and Craig Tugger, his thing was he used to walk between the two scrums, the two packs of forwards, and he'd put the ball in the air and, Henry's on. And I was like, I'm 20 years old, right? And I looked across as Craig, and I was just thinking, no, not now. It didn't work out for me. Like, thankfully, Craig Young put me out of my misery really quickly. I kind of came into rugby league when there was a sense of change happening in and about the game. Like, you had a place like Wayne Pearce.
Yeah.
And then a couple of years after me, there was...
he would have been someone like you would have looked up to, wouldn't you?
Oh,
like,
yeah, his training, the science that he brought to it, like the sporting science, which you see now, you know, it's a very different game. Then you had a couple of years after I started, you know, blokes like Brad Clyde, and that real... not an athlete's game, but there was a lot more skill involved. I mean, you look at it now, like, guys, I mean, apart from a few positions like fullback, halfback, dummy half, 5'8", maybe, everyone else is interchangeable, like from wingers to front rowers. They're all running 13 seconds and 100 metres. It's all about a game of centimetres. I mean, even the ball now, you can hold that ball out. You know, you can hold that ball stretched out with your hand because it's grip. The science in the sport. Back when I was playing, we had like those leather balls. Once they got wet, it was like carrying a block of block of cement around.
I remember the Australian team coming to Long Bay, 1986, with Jack Gibson, and I had this leather Steedon Australian football signed by the whole team. I seen Wayne Pearce the other day. He still looks fit enough to play. Him and his wife Terry.
He's doing all right, mate. He's mixed up with the commission. Rugby League Commission, the Sports Commission,
Let's go back a bit. You grew up, was it Maroubra? You went to school in Maroubra?
Yeah, Maroubra. I went from school from in Maroubra, kindergarten right through to high school. I didn't really have, I wasn't really gifted intellectually, mate. My family, my mum and dad came out to, we're English, I'm English. Mm. My brother, older brother and my older sister are all English. My mum and dad came out as 10-pound poms with three kids in tow. I had another little girl when they got here. They're only really coming out for a bit of a holiday for 2 years, because the idea was back then, if you came out as a 10-pound pond, you could go back after 2 years and the government would pay for the trip back. So the initial plan was just to come out and have a holiday. Like I said, they come out, three kids in tow, 300 pound in their pocket. And
same with my parents come out from Liverpool.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah. I got three brothers and a sister born in Liverpool, England. Me and my brother born in Liverpool, Australia.
Right, okay, yeah.
So I'm a Scouser.
Right.
But, okay, so What age did you start playing league?
I was about 4 or 5. Just like, that's just what you did, you know, like, that's just what everyone did. It was...
It's cultural in that area.
Yeah,
right?
It's like, it was absolutely what it is, a cultural thing. It's and it's just what everyone did.
And like, you were aspired back then. Like, there was only one team you could play for.
South. Yeah. We used to go to... my mum and dad were big South. They ended up becoming big South supporters. We used to go to Redfern all the time. I'd be sliding down the... You remember the old hills? Back there, down the mud?
Yeah.
But yeah, like, we were just... Mum and Dad had the same spots behind the goalposts at the south end for since I can remember.
And who was your favourite player when you were growing up? How did you look up to him?
It wasn't really a South player. I mean, the first couple of players that come to mind for me were Ray Price and Bobby Fulton and Bozo.
You ended up being coached by Bozo, didn't you?
Yep. Champion, mate. Absolutely. He would be the best coach I got. I probably played my best football under Boz. He was he'd let players use what they were good at. Excel at what they were good at.
Smart businessman.
Yeah.
Okay. So when was your first rep? What first rep team did you make? You start making rep teams?
Man, I was always pretty good at sport. Like I said, like, schooling was never my thing. I couldn't read and write. Like, dyslexia wasn't a thing growing up. Like, that wasn't a diagnosis back then. You were just dumb.
Yeah, I got that one.
I had to repeat first class.
I did too.
It was the most embarrassing thing. And I don't think I ever really got over that shame of always being a year older than everyone else in my year. And I couldn't read and write. That was, like, of all the things, I was never worried about being same-sex attracted, ever.
Yeah.
But the thing of not being able to read and write and being that kid every time you'd have to, the teacher would tell you to stand up and read a page of the booklet and making the scene where you make it about something else and you get sent out the room or whatever, that dickhead was me.
Yeah. Mate, I was always at the principal's office on the naughty chair.
Yeah.
I get it. So what year did you go actually into grade?
In 85, I was playing B grade at Mascot. And then the last six games of the year, I just got called up, played under 23s, and I played 4 reserve grade games. That was then in 86, I was, George took over, George Piggins.
What made that South side, what made them so tough? What was the ingredients that made all them boys so tough? Because that...
it was a different formula of rugby league then, but mate, there was a lot more confrontational stuff and a lot more physical, like, stuff that you couldn't get away with now. Some players would get banned for life, some of the stuff that went on. That was kind of the way that the game was played back then. It was like much more confrontational, much more one-on-one stuff as well. We weren't the most skilled side. What we lacked in probably... like finesse, we made up for it in coming as a pack.
Yeah. Oh, you had something.
Yeah.
You guys had something, and everyone talks about it. I've seen Bundy
champion
a couple of years ago up at, he was full of piss, but when I seen him, he was funny ass. A sad part about it, a lot of those players, they've got look at Mario, the concussion, really sad.
It's so unfortunate, but that's becoming such a familiar story. Mario's not the only person from that era. Like, there's been a number of players now, there's still a lot of embarrassment about it and players speaking up about it because, you know, it affects you personally, affects you, your own profile and how people perceive you after that once you... I tip my hat to Mario doing that, totally owning it and doing it for the good of the cause and hopefully being able to help other people. But there was a lot of other people. And you know, it's now a diagnosis as well. It's a real thing. Like, people get, this comes from, like, head knocks. This is not a good thing. Like, at least now there's some science behind it. We've still got a lot of work to do, but they, I think all the rule changes, I'm all for all the rule changes. The safer we can make the game, the more inclusion and the more kids you'll have playing it. Yeah. And it's just got to be safer, mate. Like, we just don't like to see that stuff. It's like, you know, I think the generations before me, Mario is probably a generation older than me.
We're talking about Mario Fenwick, South Sydney front rower, North Sydney front rower.
Champion bloke. He's 3 or 4 years older than me, and when he first came into grade, like, all that stuff, there was a lot more, like, blues, and there's a lot more illegal stuff that was not so much accepted. It was just part of the – it's just the kind of the way the game was played.
I remember seeing Andy Gregory just take – were you in that game when he just took out Bradley Clyde? He just whacked him and he –
I had a season in Wigan, right? Yeah. After the under 23s grand final in what year was it, 86? I flew out the next day to play in Wigan, and a week later I was playing against Andy Gregory, and I didn't know who he was, right? He's a smaller, nuggety halfback, yeah. And over there you can change teams mid-season, right? So I was playing for Wigan, we played for Warrington. And I'll never forget it. Like, it was about 5 minutes into the game, and he tackled me, and then I got up, I played the ball. I'd hurt my ankle or something, I'd gone down to, like, have a look at my ankle, and he's booted me in the head. And then he said, "You Aussie." I looked up at him, and I'm just like, what's going on? But the next week, he was playing alongside me. He transferred to Wigan.
Yeah.
And and I saw him at trade. He said, "I hope it wasn't out of line about all that stuff."
It was nothing personal.
Nothing personal. But he was a real warrior. Oh, my God. He was crazy.
I remember as an international game, he just walked out and just swing arm, took Bradley Clyde out the game. And I think he just got sent off and maybe he would be out of the game now.
Yeah, that's what that's a bygone era, mate. Like, and thankfully, I'm a dinosaur. You know, like I get it. Like, a lot of the stuff that I do, players can't do anymore. But I think that's healthy for the game. Like, you've got to look at it. You don't want these ongoing issues about, you know, CTE and all that. It's like,
I work with lawyers. They're coming at the game at the moment. Absolutely. They're asking me to find players. But now, when did it sort of come to you? Because in your book, I remember your first sort of gay encounter was with you were on a camp, a football camp, when you were about 15 or 16.
Oh, no. I can never not remember being same-sex attracted, whatever that means, all right?
Yeah.
I have an instance, and I know this is that it was 1972 when I first realised, and I didn't associate with the word gay, but when I realised that I was different, it was because there was a show on TV called Checkerboard on the ABC, and we've only just had the 50th anniversary of this show. The Checkerboard show was it was a documentary about homosexuals. Even hearing that word now sounds weird, doesn't it? But it was the first time that two gay men had kissed on TV. And I was sat next to my dad. We were watching the TV. It was 1972, so I would have been 7 years old. These two men had kissed on TV. And I remember thinking, oh, that's what I'm like. I do that with Barry Riley, the next door neighbor.
Shout out to you, Barry.
But my dad, and I use the language my dad said. I thought, oh, I'm like that. That's how I fit. I'm like that. I could understand that. But my dad said, oh, you know, they make my fucking skin creep. Mm. And I also realised at that point, oh, this is something that needs to be kept to yourself. I mean, I grew up in an incredibly loving, like, household, mate, but there was a lot of misogynistic, racist, homophobic, language.
And that comes back, that's English. That was the English culture.
I mean, you know, it's a terrible thing to say this. And my mum and dad went on such a journey. You know, they became, you know, like LGBTIQA+ allies, like the best allies of all time. But they went on a real journey. And when they initially left England to get – this sounds awful, but I'll say what they used to say – to get away from the blacks.
Mm.
I mean, that even hearing that stuff, it kind of spins me out. But, you know, their journey is fantastic. They won an absolute 180, yeah.
Given your mum and dad had those strong opinions – tell me about the first conversations that took place about your sexuality.
Well, it was difficult, mate, because I was...
Do you reckon they suspected it?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, yes, but they'd always denied it too. Like, you know, it's kind of weird. We've got the old 8mm films, you know, from when we were kids. Yeah. And you can see how camp I am in some of those films, mate. When I'm 6 and 7 running around, flapping my wrists around and, like, I mean... and I'm like, yeah, look at that. Like, come on, Mum. That's
a telltale sign.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, but I mean, it was difficult, mate. I went through a patch when I first came out to my parents. I mean, everyone's coming out story is very personal, but mine was probably a little bit more public because of my profile.
Mm.
I mean, I was never closeted in the fact that, you know, I was always out, always had a a boyfriend and that growing up, you know, like a, not a boyfriend that I was publicly open with, you know, it was always a boyfriend in secret type thing. But because I was always out on the scene, you know, that's how that's why I was saying earlier that it was the worst kept secret in rugby league. But there are some things you can't protect those people you care about from. And the thing that I couldn't stop was when people like were shouting homophobic, you know, "Robert, you faggot," you know, like, and all that. Well, the thing that used to upset me most because my mum and dad were at the football, they would hear that stuff, right? And like I said, but there are some things you just can't protect those people that you care about from, like. My mum used to work at Qantas, and this is the coming out. This is what brought it to a head. My mum used to work at Qantas, and there was two boys sitting. And anyway, so she's at lunch. There's two boys sitting opposite. I was only telling this story yesterday at a at another event. There's two boys sitting opposite her at the lunch table reading an article on me, right? Not knowing that my mum sat opposite them. My mum's having a sandwiches, and one boy, and I'm going to use the language again, right? So people realise how impactful language can be and how devastating, like, you know.
Words are weapons.
Words are weapons, right? Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, one boy says to the other boy, "Oh, that's him, that Roberts, he got caught sucking a guy off on Oxford Street." Right? Now, let me just premise this by that's not fucking true.
Wasn't on Oxford Street, it was on William Street.
Yeah. Yeah.
I got the streets wrong.
No, I didn't get caught. No, it was just two boys bantering about being homophobic shit, you know? Like,
yeah, as they do.
But you can only imagine how my mum, like, is in, like, literally a metre away, but, like, she's devastated. She's been to the footy. She's heard all these slurs and blah, blah, blah. Later that night, I got a phone call off my dad when I got home from training. He says, "Oh, boy, you got to come round, you know." So I got home. It was like walking into a funeral parlour. I was like, God, it felt like someone had died. It's like, oof. My mum was bawling. My dad's like, "Boy, you're going to need to sit down and talk to us." And I'm like, what's happened? Like, they told me, you know, what happened. And obviously they didn't believe the story either, but they just said, like, you know, "We hear things all the time. We just want to hear you say that you're not gay, and that's good enough for us." That's what my dad said, right? Mm-hmm. Just want to hear you say.
He wanted a disclaimer.
"You're not gay, and that's good enough for us." And I just, like, at that point, I was like, I was about 23, 24, I think. And my mum's bawling. Anyway, so I just said to him, "Yeah, Dad, I'm gay." And the crazy thing, my dad looks at me like, he goes, "Blake," he says, "but you play front row."
Only meant for centres.
I was like, "How did you even go there?" Like, what? He was shocked. My mother was howling, and didn't go well anyway. You know, like, then I got the whole thing. "Oh, you've got to keep this quiet. You've got to, you know, you've got to never let anyone know and find out about this." And I'm like, "Oh no, I'm kind of over all that. You know, I'm kind of just fed up with that shit. Like, I just, it's not my problem anyway." But then I got the, "Well, you know, we don't want you to bring your boyfriend around here." And I was like, "Well, if I can't bring my partner around, and my brother and sisters brought their partners around all the time," I said, "look, I'm not coming here." And I didn't see my family really. I had a really bad relationship for about 3 years after that.
That must have hurt.
Yeah, but it is what it is too. I mean, you know, I'm a bit pig-headed. I can't get that from my dad.
Yeah.
And stubborn. But it is what it is. I mean, I don't know. Like, that's not a tragic story. That's not an inspirational story. But there are thousands of stories out there that are 1,000 times worse than that. You know what I mean? There are some people that they get thrown out of home, that get totally rejected. You know,
that's why suicide's so prevalent.
It's awful, mate. Yeah.
Suicide's so prevalent in a gay community.
It's crazy, mate. Yeah, 5 times more likely.
Yeah? Is that the stats?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Can I tell you my coming out party? I got out of prison. I'll tell you quickly a quick story. In 1998, I got a midnight release from prison, right? So it was 1 second past midnight. And I got picked up by a limo at Windsor Jail and drove down to Biblos on Oxford Street.
Oh.
And it was my getting out party, right? And Jim Dimmick were there, Nick Kosseff and that were there.
Yeah.
And a couple of guys goes, "Mate, when did you come out?" And I said, "Oh, mate, last midnight." And they said, "How does your family feel?" I said, "They feel great. I'm having seafood lunch with them today, you know. Have you had any backlash?" I said, "Have you had any backlash?" And I said, "No, I'm fucking..." And I said, I'm looking for a job. And they said, oh, yeah. And he's gay. This guy.
Oh, got that's
this.
Gold, mate. Where did you come out? Oh, I just come out, mate. I'm just.
1 second past midnight. What were you waiting for? And I was like, this guy.
That's gold. I'm going to use that story. Myself. Yeah, I'm going
to. Well, this guy came up to me and he had a pair of jodhpurs on and a skull cap and no shirt on, a little crop. And he came up and he's doing his dance. He said, how does it feel to come out? And I said, fucking fantastic.
Fuck, I've been liberated.
I'm free. And it was like, and then Jim said, ah, and he starts laughing. Oh. Jim says, oh, you know what it is? He said, they think it's your coming out party. And I said, it's me getting out party.
Oh, that's gold, mate. That's one of the best stories of all time.
I was going along with it. Yeah, fucking great to be out. About five or six blokes asked me. One bloke came and kissed me. I said, that's a bit rude.
mate, you're pushing the boundary.
Yeah. You know, they kissed me on the lips. I went, hey, boy.
That is gold.
When you did come out, like, was there a sense of relief? Like, it was,
like I said, it allowed everyone to breathe out. Just everyone's like, oh, thank fuck for that, he's done it. Like mm-hmm. we don't have to fucking tiptoe around that fucking all the landmines anymore.
But you encourage so many young people. Like, you're known as a gay icon because of that.
The sport has such a reach, like that you know, that the arts and that politics. And that the legal professions don't. Like, sport is like for the everyday person, the everyday man. Like, and I can appreciate the position I played, and I did have like the reputation I had. But a lot of that was, you know, the reason I had that reputation, and I used to, because I was conscious of my sexuality too, and always having to feel like sometimes. You know, I just wanted not to be a better man, but just to be in that world, that aggressive world, just like the equal of anyone else, if that makes sense.
Oh, 100% it makes sense. I think you changed the persona of people have of gay people.
Stereotypes.
Yeah, the stereotype. I think you single-handedly, big, muscly, can fight, don't fuck with him, because people think, I'll tell you one thing, people think Ian Roberts, they think gay footballer, and they said, you see what he did to Gary Jack?
Yeah.
Can we mention that?
Yeah. I mean,
I know you're not too proud of it. But
no, I'm not. I mean, it's that was just a young guy acting out. I mean,
was there any homophobic slur or anything? People have asked me that.
Mate, no, it wasn't around that. That was all my own insecurities, mate. It was just like I'm not proud of what happened.
And he sued you over it, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, it cost me plenty too, and rightfully so. Like, I'm not denying that. I've apologised to him. I've apologised to his family.
Yeah,
Manly.
You're playing for Manly then, eh?
Yeah.
I can remember the uppercuts. They were brutal. I felt them. You know, in prison, in jail, prison knows society secrets. And we all knew in '92 that you were gay.
Yeah.
Everyone, like, they know everyone's who got who and who's having sex with who and what politician goes and visits the glory holes. Yeah. And they know everyone's, and a lot of people, and everyone said, yeah, he's gay. You know, and another blokes would go, fucking look at the size of him, mate. You know, him coming at you.
It's funny, you know, because I used to, like, the opposite, I used to sometimes get that, like, in reverse from the gay community. I did, I mean, maybe it was on my own insecurities or whatever, but I always used to feel that that I didn't fit the mold either. Like, that was always, I questioned myself about that, that stereotype growing up and what I'd always been told was gay as well, and that was never me. I used to have a real, like, I did used to have some problems with that sometimes about not being any of those stereotypes, but that's all they are. But like, you kind of learn that as you mature and get older. I mean, and the other thing is, man, I look back at that person that I was. I'd love to be able to have a chat to that 25-year-old bloke. Like, and
what would you say?
Mate, things would be okay. Just.
Yeah, settle.
chill. Just things would be okay, mate. Just have some chocolate. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I look back now. I mean, we're talking about something that was like 30-odd years ago. Like, I don't even know who that person was. Like, you know what I mean? Like, 30. Yeah, I mean, I remember kind of what I was thinking, but I think so much has changed since then.
I want to touch on something too, because I'm an abusive. I'm a sexual abusive. And that happened to you too, didn't it? You were sexually abused How old were you then?
I was about 15. the man who sexually abused me, was his name was Fredericks.
Mm. I know their name. I know their names come up in the work we do. Because, look, I talk about, in the work, I've got a business called The Voice of a Survivor, and we help survivors of institutional abuse. I've got 16,500 clients. Me coming out and telling my story of abuse, it was like so healing for me. And to be able to freely talk about it, because they say a perpetrator's greatest weapon is his victim's silence and shame. You know, and what did that leave you with, that abuse?
You know, it's kind of weird because when it happened, happened twice, right? When it happened, in my head, I mean, the thing that I had to deal with, because I already knew, I'm going to use the word gay, but even though I wasn't associating with that word, I knew I was same-sex attracted even back then, right? But I was like, I thought he knew that I was same-sex attracted, and that's what almost gave him permission to...
And so you blamed yourself.
In a way, just like, how did he know that, like, I mean, I was in no way attracted to him. Like, I'm not saying that at all. But that's what fucked my head. Like, just like, how did he know... Like, that's what I took. And maybe I'm giving off some sort of sign or some sort of... You know what I mean? That really troubled me. And that's why I kept quiet about it. I was just like...
Abuse survivors feel like that. The hetero ones, I felt like it. You know, and the whole thing is I carry a backpack of shit that didn't belong to me. It was like guilt, shame, embarrassment, and everything like that. But when I started telling my story... I was taking that backpack off and pelting it back at the perpetrator and saying, this shit's yours, you carry it. And I say that's one of the biggest things I say to survivors, you know. We carry stuff that don't belong to us as survivors, you know, the detrimental. Do you think any of your aggression came out of that?
Potentially, yes, but I can't say. I do remember, like, particularly when I went to Manly and I felt like I had to step up and be on the field more of an enforcer type role and that kind of... I needed to do that for myself. I mean, it might play into it. I don't really know, mate, but I do know that I knew I was gay, and I just like, I've got to rise above what if I don't give 150%, or if I don't be like that little bit better, or whatever that is. What, you know, if I don't be the absolute, at least the equal, then I'm always gonna be the lesser. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, yeah. I get it. You know, and that's why I think Indigenous players are so freaky. You know, they're always just fucking, they always get that, I'm going to prove to you that I'm as good, if not better than you. I'm so impressed by Indigenous sports people.
I would absolutely agree with that, mate.
They are amazing. Recently, was it six players refused to wear the
Manly jersey? Yeah, that's, that whole situation... Obviously, it was poorly handled. It could have been handled a lot better. It's not the way you wanted to get, you know, a conversation around a pride round started. But, you know, if nothing else, it definitely got it started, the conversation. But I was kind of weird because Manly rang me a couple of months before the game. And initially, it was going to be a women's round. But they wanted to make it more inclusive. So they thought we'd make it a pride round, make it much more inviting and welcoming, you know, like to everyone. And my initial reaction as like a 57-year-old gay man, only because where I come from, every time we've had this discussion, the community, the pride community, the LGBTQA+ community, always start from a point where we have to know that we're going to have to make concessions, and we're going to have to be very flexible. You know, like it's like this is where we are, this is where you want to be. This is progress, you know what I mean? Like, we know that we're going to have to be, like, very flexible, willing to negotiate and compromise and all that. Unfortunately, you know, when they told me they were doing this, and my initial reaction as a 57-year-old gay man knowing that was like, if you guys had no pushback, like, that was my initial reaction. Just, like, you know...
It's going too easy.
Yeah, like, the whole... religious side of things is where I always expect to see some sort of pushback, and they were like, no, we haven't. And knowing what we know now, they just hadn't spoken to enough people.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? That was – so, yeah, it ended up being, like, total chaos. I mean, I will say that I'm kind of proud of Manly went through with it. They were talking at one stage they were going to, you know, not have the pride round, but they went through with it. You know, and their season absolutely collapsed after that. I think they lost every game after that.
And Des lost his job, yeah.
Des lost his job. But, you know, like, I just – a bit of credit to Des here. I had a conversation with him a few weeks after all that hoo-ha. And for anyone who knows Des, knows how competitive he is, right? Like, as a player, like, he was incredibly competitive, and it was all about winning. But even he said to me, Robbo, mate, I didn't realise that, you know, some things are more important than two competition points, and that made me realise just, you know, how much discrimination your community has to put up with. Like, that's a big call. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, that was...
Would have felt good, man.
Oh, yeah, it did for me. And, like, I love Desi. Like, I have so much respect for the guy. But,
you and him would get a lot, how he's trained, like, he's
yeah,
like... He's
yeah, like he was like a thoroughbred horse.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. But you know, the other thing is, like, one of the major sponsors of the NRL is an organisation called Pride in Sport. And this is a crazy thing. They have this they actually facilitate Pride rounds.
Mm.
Did the NRL or Manly even reach out to them? No.
No.
That's what they do. It's like, it's crazy that, like, you know, they have this other sports index where it's about creating a safe environment for the queer community, like in sporting corporations. I think only four of the NRL teams have run with the index, and like, it should be compulsory, that type of thing. But if we're going to make the game more inclusive and diverse and whatever that means, you know, you got to at least mate, be willing to have a conversation. You can't just say point blank, no, I have no bar of that.
I think. I was talking to someone. I was talking to a woman last night and her husband, and I think I was talking about interviewing you, and they're big fans anyway. Being in the closet is very similar to being in prison. It's so much like it. I think you can't be yourself. You dictate society. People beyond you are dictating terms in your life.
That's a pretty good comparison. I mean, I can only imagine. Yeah,
yeah, it's that they are, and they're shitbags with bad breath and fucking bad attitude that are fucking dictating the fucking in terms in your life, and it's fucking sad. And it's really what you do in your bedroom or in your lounge room or in your fucking washing machine's got nothing to fucking do with me. You know what I mean? And that's fucking sad. People dictating who you can love.
Who you can care about.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what it comes like. That's, you know, it's who you can care about. It's like, and when I say care, it's like we're talking like, you know, parents and children, and the way that can affect those types of relationships too. It's just not, you know, same sex people like who have a relationship. It's a whole extent. It's a whole community. Like, I totally agree, mate. It's I'm a director of an organisation called Qtopia Sydney. We're trying to create an LGBTIQA+ museum here, like a pride museum here in Sydney. We had a huge announcement last week. The Murdoch, Sarah and Lachlan Murdoch Foundation donated $1 million to it.
Wow.
We've had some other really good Shore and Partners just made a really fantastic donation to one of our. But the reason
what would it entail? What would entail the museum?
It's around education, celebration, and remembrance, mate.
Yeah.
The education is where I'm big on. My partner actually works for Jason Clare. He's an advisor for Jason Clare. He's federal education minister. My partner Dan used to be a school teacher. Used to help write curriculum for the education department. I'm really big on education, mate. And I'm now talking from primary school right through to the corporate realm. World. We would be facilitating programs around this space, around queer space and pride, LGBTIQA+ issues. The educational side of things, that's what I'm big on, the educational side of things. The celebration side of things is where we are and celebrating who we are and just what we were talking about, like building healthy communities, relationships. I mean, things like letting people know what all the letters of the alphabet, like all the letters of the queer community stand for and what they represent. You know, things like, simple things like, what's a safe space?
Yeah.
Like people think it's a silly question. I said, well, a safe space looks very different for someone with a disability as it does to someone of colour or someone who's transitioning to like a cis white man. You know what I mean? They're very, like, the safe spaces. There's a lot just even in that space, you know. And then remembrance, mate, like we'd be looking right back through before colonisation to our First Nations people and how they dealt with this and the way that they embraced their queer community right through colonisation, right through, you know, the whole Mardi Gras thing. People think because of marriage equality, everything was sorted we're good now.
Yeah.
There's still an incredible amount of work. We were speaking earlier, mate, about suicide figures, and they're awful.
I didn't realise that.
If you're in LGBTIQA+ people, are five times more likely to attempt suicide. Trans people are 11 times more likely to, those types of statistics are awful. Like, and they're not. We have to be like mature enough to have this conversation.
We do.
You know, and that's what a museum. A museum's almost like a beacon of hope for people as well, mate, because it's an actual premise. It's a safe space for people out in the regional areas of the country areas. They know they're coming to a safe space, and it's an educational space. Yeah, for the last 3 years, that's kind of all I've been working on.
Good on you. After football, Nida, I've drove past that joint. It looks like a prison. There's little cameras everywhere. And how did you end up in there?
It's very much a prison. Mate, I was always, I said before that I couldn't read and write, right? So I learnt to read and write when I went to Nida.
What's the acronym stand for?
National Institute of Dramatic Arts.
Yeah.
Mate, and like I said, when I say I can read and write, I can function now. I'm no Shakespeare.
Yeah.
I'm not going to start writing sonnets. But growing up, I was always part of the ensemble acting stuff at school, right through primary. Right, but I could never sight read because I couldn't read, literally. Mm. I was always in the chorus I was always in the second tree from the left or the cleaner at the right. So my car, this is now a couple of years after I retired from footy. I was also in a bad place with my mental health, at that point, because I couldn't really...
Did you lose your purpose after football?
Absolutely, mate. I'd like it. Yeah, absolutely. It was...
happens to a lot of footballers, doesn't it?
It's a big black hole I fell into. Mm. It took me a long time to crawl out of it. But that's a really familiar story.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's such a... it's kind of weird because you feel like you've already peaked in your life, you know what I mean? It's like, oh...
Did you finish your career at North Queensland Cowboys, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah. It was great. Anyway, so it was a couple of years after that, and my car broke down just up the road from Nida, Anzac Parade there at the Kingsford, and I was walking by there, and I thought, I'll just duck in there and see if there's someone, because I thought I'd like to get back into doing some community theatre or whatever, maybe there might be someone that can help me. They put me in touch with a bloke by the name of Kevin Jackson. I love Kevin. I went to his funeral just a month ago. He, outside of my family, my direct family, probably had more impact on my life as a person than any other, particularly male mentor in my life. So I met him, and he said, "Oh, look," he gave me half an hour. He said, "Come on, we'll see where you're at, and we'll take it from there." So he asked me to spot read, and I was like, "Oh shit!"
No,
it was embarrassing.
Can't read out loud. I can read, but I do that, and I sound like I'm just.
I said to him, it was so embarrassing. You start flush, all your face flushes, and you just feel and he said, "Oh, you're okay?" And he said,
shame's a horrible thing.
Oh, it's awful, mate. And I just said, I can't read. I can make out some of the words, but I'm not really. And he was like, this is where the change happened. It was one of those light bulb moments in my life. He was like, "Oh, don't worry about it." He said, "Are you dyslexic?" And I hadn't been diagnosed by them, right? And I said, "No, I'm just dumb." He said, no, not at all. This happens all the time. He says, "What we'll do is we'll tape the dialogue, go home, listen to the tape, learn the dialogue through memory, and we'll come back tomorrow and we'll give it a go then." And it was so not an issue for him. He said, "Oh, we get dyslexic people here all the time." He said, that's not. But it was the first time anyone in my life, it was so not an issue. It was almost like it was one of the most empowering moments of my life.
And it had caused you so much grief.
And so much angst. I mean, I was still holding on to that when I had to repeat first grade. Yeah. When the teacher told my mum and dad, "Oh, we want him to repeat first grade." My dad's like, "Oh, okay, whatever."
Yeah.
It was not an issue. And I was reliving that moment all over again. But Kevin was just like, and it was so not an issue ever with Kevin. And then there's this thing called phonetics. It's like an alphabet in itself, but it's a little bit, for me it was much easier to learn because you actually spell words the way they sound.
Yeah.
Yes, like I said, I learned to read and write good enough to spot read and sight read. Yeah. Wow. It was wonderful, mate. It was it's so empowering.
How long were you at Nida for?
4 years. The course was 3 years. I was there for... After I saw Kevin, Kevin was doing some just one-on-one stuff with me for about a year. Mm. He said, "Why don't you do do the degree, do the course, a 3-year course. I'm like, oh, man, I'm too old. And he said, oh, if you like, and again, words of wisdom, if you're good enough, you're old enough. I mean, that's normally you say that in reverse if you're too young, you know. Like he said, oh, if you're good enough, you're old enough.
I spoke to Dean Morrison, pro surfer, the other day, and I said, he just said something to me, and I said about surfing. I said, I'm too old for surfing. He goes, you know the bloke, the best surfer in the ocean? And I said, oh, he said, the one who's having the best time.
Yeah, great. Absolutely spot on.
It's very similar to what you were just saying then. You went to Hollywood.
Yeah, I lived over there for about off and on for about 6 years. Yeah. It was great. Like it was, but let's be honest, mate. I was fortunate. I had a career in rugby league because if I was trying to survive on my acting checks to feed me, I would have gone pretty hungry.
Yeah. I've seen a photo shoot of you at Santa Monica Beach.
Oh, like I did like well over 30 like movies and that over there, but nothing substantial.
And then come back, Underbelly, you've done Underbelly, George Freeman's Bodyguard.
Yeah, we just, I've been lucky enough to work off and on, you know, for the last 10 years here in Australia.
You know, I remember watching the movie The Sum of Us, Jack Nicholson, and that was the first movie about...
Russell Crowe.
Yeah, Russell Crowe.
Russell Crowe.
And that, and you talk about the kissing scene and that sort of thing, you know what I mean? I remember watching it in jail and people go, oh.
Russell, like I met Russell once and he said to me that he got most enjoyment because after that he did Romper Stomper.
Yeah.
Polar opposites, right? He said he used to love that because not many people who'd seen Romper Stomper had watched Some of Us.
Yeah.
And then he was promoting, as on his, when he was promoting Romper Stomper, he'd tell them to all watch Some of Us, only because it's just blow their blow the bigots' minds.
get all the skinheads watching fucking Some of Us. Get that in you.
Yeah.
And do you think that was like a sort of a pivotal moment in Australian?
Any visibility, mate, is good.
Mm.
Any visibility is good. I think it's positive. You know, you can't be what you can't see, particularly for younger people growing up. You know what I mean? Anything is good.
I like that word. I like that saying. You can't be what you can't see. I like it.
Yeah.
I'm stealing it.
Any visibility, I think it'll be a much healthier situation. And we were a long way off it when sexuality doesn't come into, you know, the actor's performance or if
you're not judged on it.
Yeah, you know what I mean. But you know, but that still happens. You know, it is what it is.
I've been living on the Gold Coast. I've just come back to Sydney. I've just been living on the Gold Coast for about six. I've been out of jail 6 years, but just come back down, and I'm noticing. There's a real big celebration. There's a big change down here in that 6 years. I've seen like the banks are celebrating, you know, it's on the buses. Like people are really embracing Pride Month. Do you feel of a much of a change? Have you felt?
But corporations are realising now that you know, a safe space is a better environment for output from their employees. Diversity and inclusion, that's why it's important, mate. It's all about the bottom line.
Yeah.
If it wasn't improving their bottom line, you know, like they get it now. They get it. It's like, you know, like when someone's happy and brings their true self to work and they're comfortable, they work better.
Yeah.
There's more output. There's more productivity. You know, it's like that's a no-brainer. And it's also... all those little small victories that the queer community, the Pride community have had, you know, since the 1978s, since Mardi Gras and all that.
Is that was the first Mardi Gras?
It was Mardi Gras before that. But that's the one that gets the most recognition because that's when there was all those assaults, police grooming, like there was a whole lot of bashings and the police.
Because it used to be a crime to be homosexual.
Yeah, crazy.
How far, what year did that law change?
I couldn't tell.
That would have been the
80, early 80s. But, you know, the progress, I mean, and that's what I mean, you know, that's why things like the museum are important because, you know, you don't want to make those same mistakes like we did. It's like when the police first marched in Mardi Gras about 10 years ago, there was a whole lot of pushback because a lot of the original 1978ers and the older generation didn't think it was appropriate because of all the bashings and that used to occur. But that's you know, that's progress. Like we're embracing it now. Like the police now celebrate it. They've got one of the most popular.
The prison officers haven't. I've seen the prison officers float and I said, that's bullshit. There's two of them on it. There's a fucking lot more. And I think that even with the prison officers, I think there's an indoctrination within the prison, and they're homophobic, they are racist, and a lot's got to change in that job. And that terminology, faggot and porf and all that sort of stuff, that is prevalent amongst them.
I can only imagine, mate.
Crazy. Hey, what would you say to a young 16-year-old bloke or boy or whatever now that's struggling to come out about, you know, about their sexuality? What would be the advice that you would give them?
There are many services that people can reach out to if they're feeling like, you know, if they're doubting themselves or having issues. There are many, many services that you can reach out to, and they're easily accessed. If someone's having issues, I mean, speak to your school teacher. Like, you know, I'd like to say that, you know, just tell your mum and dad and how you're feeling, but in a lot of times that's just not going to be practical advice because it's not a safe environment. It possibly could not be a safe environment. I mean, my I don't think that advice would have helped me, like, growing up. But, you know, the crazy thing is I look at my partner, Dan. Dan and I had been together like 18 years. He never came out, only because he'd never had to come out. He started bringing boys home, and that was always just okay. You know, it was a safe. You get what I'm saying? Like, that would be the ideal world where you don't have to come out. Like, it's just like, you know, whoever you come, I'm bringing I'm bringing my partner home this weekend, and mum and dad. It could be a boy, you know, it might be a boy or a girl, whatever. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, my mate set me up once. My mate worked for Telstra. And he put all gay magazines under my bed with crunched up tissues and Vaseline intensive care.
It set you up.
It set me up. And my mum, I came home from work one and my mum said, son, I wouldn't bother me if you were gay. And I said, mum, if I was gay, I'd tell you. And she'd go, what are them magazines you've got under your bed? And it went up and I said, they're fucking not much. She goes, no, mate, come here, give us a hug.
Of course they're not. Of course they're not.
I still think she died thinking, you know, that I went that way for a while. But. And you're a credit, Anne, honestly. The gay community should be fucking privileged to have you, because I'll tell you what I think, and I really believe this. I believe that you made the gay community, in particular in Sydney, the gay community, it's safer for gay people to walk the streets. And I'll tell you why. These people going gay bashing, if you walk around the corner, they ain't bashing you.
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate. That's,
still happens, doesn't it?
Absolutely, mate. And I'm only saying that because just recently, probably within the last month, a dear friend of mine just... like a good friend of mine was just like really badly assaulted.
How do you feel about that?
It upsets me. Like, it's sad, man. I mean, it angers me. It's all those things. It's such a mixture of emotion. I just, like, I don't get it, mate. I just don't get it. Like,
but that goes back to education.
It's exactly, and that's why education is so important. I said about, you know, our sword and our shield. It's our greatest weapon, mate. It is really what will change it. And it has to start from it has to come from the younger generation. I mean, people, like hardheads like you and I, we're kind of set in our way now. Like, it's... Oh, but even saying that, you know, like even that's open to scope. I look at my dad and how and his the way he changed, you know, like
Joe Dispenza. I listen to my daughter, Dr. Joe Dispenza. He's a neuroscientist. I listen to his podcast, and he says all your beliefs and out of form by the time you're 32.
Yeah,
it's hard. He said, but there's ways of doing it, and through experience, you know.
My dad, like the change in him was, like I said, 180. I mean, just. Before he died, my dad did I got interviewed. I think it was a 60-minute thing, and they asked one of the reporters had to ask my dad. He said, "Oh, you must be very proud of your son." And my dad, like a man of very few words, he said, "So the reporter said, you know, you must be very proud of your son," referring to me. And my dad said, "I'm equally proud of all my children, but I am very grateful that I was given a gay son because I got to see the world as it really was."
Wow.
Unbelievable, right? Like, unbelievable. Yeah. But that's all that had to be said. Like, you know, even starting with, I'm equally as proud of all my children.
Wow, beautiful. What a beautiful thing to have someone say about you. I remember the last time I went before a judge, he said, I'm an asset to the community now. I used to be an enemy of the state. Now I'm an asset because of the work I do at Voice of it. And man, I get that. Something that totally powerful, that powerful to hear your dad say that, you know?
Yeah, but I mean... You know, there's a lot of good work being done in politics and that too now. Like, that's why this museum is so important to me. Like, it really is a bit of a legacy, not just for me, but the legacy for our community, for World Pride even, you know? Like, World Pride's happening at the moment.
Fucking place is buzzing, man. We're on the eve of Mardi Gras as we record this, and it's the month of World Pride. And what are you doing to celebrate?
It's a pretty busy couple of weeks for me. In a good way. I'm doing a whole load of the parties, obviously going to the parade. like I said, you know, we talked about visibility before. It's back on the street too again now. I mean, it was great the last few years that they kept Mardi Gras going and it was continuous because of the COVID thing. They had it at the cricket ground. But it's good that it's back on the street and it's good for people in the out in the suburbs and the regional areas and come in and see it again.
Yeah, place plenty is of buzzing.
Yeah, it's great, mate. It's always wonderful, mate. This time of year, it's always a nice feel.
Yeah, and that's what we're celebrating it, but there's just a lot to celebrate, you know, and it's a beautiful thing. I'm one of these guys. I'm all about freedom, man. I'm about freedom, about racial freedom, about sexuality. Man, yeah, it's a beautiful thing, man, and you're an icon, man, and I said, that's it. I know you struggle with that, I can see it, but you are. You're an icon, you're a leader, and you have a very powerful voice, and people are going to listen to you.
I've been very fortunate, mate. I'm fully aware of that, mate. But like I said before, about the whole inspirational and tragic thing, there are just it's easy to care, mate. Like I just, you know, it's so easy to get on in this world. I often wonder why so many people choose not to. You know, it's just so easy to get on.
Love heals everything.
It sounds like that gets like thrown around, but it's so true. It's just it's okay to care about people, mate.
You know what? I talk about this all the time. Like people say, how did you make the comeback? I said, well, love to heal my trauma. I didn't get the trauma bashed out of me by a prison officer. I got, love brought me out of trauma. It was beautiful.
Anger and grief, and it's so draining.
Yeah. It is, isn't it?
It exhausts you, mate. Like holding a grudge, you know, like even holding a grudge, you're just like, oh, man, I can't be bothered anymore. Yeah, it's just like,
oh, my shoulders ain't broad enough. Yours are, but you could carry a few on them. But my shoulders ain't broad enough to carry them resentments.
Yeah.
And what's the saying? A resentment will rust the vessel it's contained in.
Very good, mate.
And having a resentment with someone's like drinking a cup of poison and hoping the other person dies from it.
Fuck that. I'm going to use both of those.
Yeah. Ian Roberts, thank you for being on the podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure. One of my favourites.
Too easy, mate. Thank you for the invitation.
Happy Mardi Gras.
Woohoo!